All right, we're in Exodus chapter 20, and of course, this is the Ten Commandments. And I realized right before I sat down here, I need to change the title of this lesson from what originally I had. It was originally entitled The Ten Commandments, and it's going to be entitled The Ten Commandments Part 1. So I hope I can do it in two parts, but I don't know when I dive into these things. So Exodus chapter 20. So just a little background here. This is about 2 months after departing from Egypt. The Israelites are summoned to the foot of Mount Sinai, or Horeb, to meet with the Lord. This is in fulfillment of a promise that God had made to Moses in the beginning when he appeared at the burning bush. And so the mountain is set aside. People spend 3 days in preparation. The morning of the third day, the Lord descends on the mountain, calls Moses up. Then he warns the people again and brings Aaron up with him. And at this point in time, Exodus chapter 20, the Ten Commandments are given. So Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy 5. Deuteronomy 5 is the Ten Commandments are repeated. But those are two places in Scripture where we have the Ten Commandments given. Now, this day, which is captured at the end of Exodus 19 and in Exodus chapter 20, the day that the Lord descends and the Ten Commandments are given, is a very special day. Stephen talks about this day in Acts chapter 7. And he's speaking about the history of the Jews and the important events in the history of the Jews that pertain to Jesus coming. And speaking about Moses, this is right before Stephen is martyred, he talks about this particular day. And he says, speaking of Moses, this is he who was in the congregation in the wilderness with the angel who spoke to him on Mount Sinai and with our fathers, the one who received the living oracles to give to us. That's Acts 7:38. So this expression that Stephen uses, he was in the congregation in the wilderness. Okay, this is, Stephen, the New Testament, the word congregation is ecclesia, from which, no surprise, we get the word ecclesiastical, which means pertaining to the church. So this is the same word that Jesus uses in Matthew chapter 16, verse 18. As growing up Catholic, I was very familiar with this verse. Jesus says, I say to you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church. And the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. It's Matthew 16, 18. So this idea of the church, so it's the same word Stephen uses. He says that he was in the congregation or the church in the wilderness. So this word church is pretty significant for us as Christians. And this word here is used throughout the New Testament applying to the church, whether we're gathered together or we're dispersed in different places. So this word that Stephen uses, the Greek ekklesia or the church, Stephen is taking this from the Septuagint in Deuteronomy chapter 4, where Moses is recounting this day. This is, and I want to read from Deuteronomy chapter 4, verses 8 to 13. So this is, I give you some background about, you know, what does the word church really mean? And where does it come from? And it comes from here. This is the first place it shows up in Scripture, in the Septuagint, the Greek word for church in the New Testament. So in Deuteronomy chapter 4, so I'm reading from Orthodox Study Bible, which is based on the Septuagint. Starting in Deuteronomy 4, I'm going to read starting in verse 8. And so it says, also, what great nation is there that has such ordinances and righteous judgments that are in all this law I set before you today? Only take heed to yourselves and diligently guard your soul, lest you forget all the things your eyes saw, and lest they depart from your heart all the days of your life. And you shall teach them to your sons and the sons of your sons, especially concerning the day you stood before the Lord your God in Horeb on the day of assembly. When the Lord said to me, gather the people to me and let them hear my words, so they may learn to fear me all the days they live on the earth and may teach their sons.
Then you came near and stood at the foot of the mountain, and the mountain burned with fire to the midst of heaven with darkness, gloom, storm, and a great voice. The Lord spoke to you from the midst of the fire. You heard the sound of the words, but saw no form. You only heard a voice. Then he declared to you his covenant, the Ten Commandments, which he commanded you to perform, and he wrote them on two tablets of stone. So this is, this is one of the three places where the expression, the Ten Commandments, appears in Scripture. The other one is in Exodus 34:28 and Deuteronomy 10:4. And also, this expression that Stephen uses, the congregation of the wilderness, it comes right out of here, Deuteronomy chapter 4. In verse 10, it says, especially concerning the day you stood before the Lord your God in Horeb on the day of assembly. That's the first place that the word ecclesia or church or assembly shows up in the Scriptures. And it appears, I think, about 80 times in the Old Testament. Very common word. And all it means is assembly. And it's nothing inherently spiritual about the word at all. It just means assembly. And it could be an assembly of good people. It could be an assembly of bad people. It's just a random assembly. In fact, in Psalm 26, designated Psalm 25 and verse 5 in the Septuagint, David says, I hate the assembly of the evildoers. So they have their churches too. So they have their assembly. So the word church is a very common word. It just means assembly. That's all it means. There's nothing good, nothing bad about it. And Jesus was saying in Matthew 16, you're Peter, and on this rock I will build my assembly. I will build my church. Mm-hmm. So that helps me to understand, okay, this is what this word means. It just means assembly in the Old Testament. And then Jesus said, I'm going to have my assembly. And then that term is used throughout the New Testament. So, you know, people have a lot of associations with the word church, but this is what it meant to the Christians in the beginning. It had nothing to do with the building, stained glass, windows, some worldly organization, and nothing, not inherently spiritual. Jesus said he was going to create his own assembly. And I think also about the passage we looked at before in 1 Peter 2, 9 and 10, he says, Peter's describing the church using the words from Exodus 19. He says, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, his own special people. These are the people. This is the assembly, and this was on. There are many assemblies in the Old Testament, but this is the day of the assembly. So this is the big one right here. So there's just a little background here. And this actually is going to become very important. This statement about the day of the assembly, later on when we look in more detail about Deuteronomy 18, verses 15 to 19, that prophecy, because Moses is saying that was prophesied, that statement was given to Moses on the day of the assembly. So this is the day that the Lord came down on Mount Sinai. So that's just a little background that we didn't have time to get into in the last lesson, but I thought that's important because this is the foundation of the church right here. So let's read Exodus chapter 20, first 18 verses. As far as we're going to get in the text today, because there's a lot in here. Now the Lord spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol or a likeness of anything in heaven above, or in the earth beneath, or in the waters underneath the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, recompensing the sins of the fathers on the children of the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing mercy to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commands. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. But the seventh day is the Sabbath to the Lord your God. In it you shall do no work, neither shall you, nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your male servant, your female servant, your cattle, nor your stranger who sojourns with you. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth and the sea and everything in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. Honor your father and mother, that it may be well with you, and your days may be long upon the good land the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his house, and neither shall you covet his field, nor his male servant, his female servant, his ox, his donkey, any of his cattle, or whatever belongs to your neighbor. Amen. So let's just pause there. So we know this is the Ten Commandments. Now the question that comes up is, how do you number the Ten Commandments? And growing up Catholic, I was taught one way to number the Ten Commandments, and I ran into people later in life who numbered them totally differently than I was taught. And so I learned that there are different ways to number the Ten Commandments. Everyone always comes up with ten, whether they're Jewish, they're Catholic, they're Protestant, Orthodox. You always come up with ten, but people number them slightly differently. And the main difference between the numbering conventions is on the first commandment. The Catholic version that I was taught was the first commandment is, I'm Lord your God, to have no other gods before me. And then part of the first commandment was also, you shall not make any images. So I was taught that. And on the other hand, I ran into people later on in life who said, no, that's the, don't make any images is the second commandment. So how you handle the first commandment and how you handle the last commandment, you shall not covet your wife, and then you shall not covet anything else. Is that one commandment or two commandments? So that's the main difference between the two numbering systems. So you may run into people who number the Ten Commandments differently than you do, but you always end up with ten, no matter how you do it. And it says the same thing. The Jews have their own particular ways to number it as well. So I'm going to, because I have to have some way of numbering these things to keep them straight, I'm going to use the convention that's used by, I say, most Protestants. The Reformed numbering convention also agrees with the Orthodox convention, which is the first commandment is there's no gods. The second commandment is don't make any images. The third, don't take the name Lord's name in vain. The fourth, observe the Sabbath. The fifth, honor your parents. The sixth, don't murder. The seventh, don't commit adultery. The eighth, don't steal. The ninth, don't bear false witness. And the tenth is don't covet the wife or anything, any of the possessions of your neighbor. So I'm going to use that convention, but I realize that some people number it slightly differently just to keep track of these. So first, a few observations in general about the Ten Commandments. And you may have noticed some of these things. So the first, by this numbering convention, the first four commandments have to do with our relationship with God or in worshiping God. There's only one God. Don't make any images. Don't take his name in vain. And honor the Sabbath. Don't work on the Sabbath. So the first set of commandments have to do with our relationship with God. The remaining six commandments relate to our relations with other people, starting with our parents and then extending to our neighbors and to others. And how we treat them. So don't murder, don't commit adultery, don't lie or steal from others, and don't covet what others have. Now, Jesus, this reminds me also, this breakdown of the two parts of the Ten Commandments reminds me of something that Jesus said about the commandments of God in Matthew 22. When they ask him, okay, which one's the most important commandment? And Matthew 22, starting in verse 36, it said, Teacher, which is the great commandment in the law? Jesus says, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. That's from Deuteronomy 6. And the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. That's Leviticus 19:18. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. So all the law of Moses, all the Ten Commandments, it all hangs on those two commandments. Love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. That's the first four. Love your neighbors yourself. That's numbers 6 through 10. So basically, that's how Jesus saw the Ten Commandments. Now, I've heard people say in sermons in the past that the law of Moses was only concerned about external observances. However, under the new covenant, God is more concerned about the heart. Clearly, that's not true. That's not how Jesus saw it. Jesus says, no, it's all about the heart. The heart's behind it. Love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And love your neighbors yourself. It's all from the heart. It's all about love. And then it extends. All the rest of it hangs on that. So Jesus saw that love was behind the law of Moses, that love was the core of the law of Moses on which all the particulars hung. And then the other thing I noticed in reading through the commandments, I mean, you may have noticed something different reading through this after not reading the Ten Commandments in a while. The thing that stuck out to me is the details in the last commandment, all the things you're not supposed to covet. So he's all the first nine commandments are the things you're supposed to do or not do. And the tenth commandment is coveting. It's all the heart in the tenth commandment. So the whole idea that God is only concerned with the externals, no. He says, don't even lust in your heart after your neighbor's wife and your neighbor's thing. So we don't have to wait to the Sermon on the Mount to get God addressing the lusts in people's hearts. Okay, so that's right in the law of Moses as well. I want to take a look at some of the specific commands, and I'll tell you right now, we're not going to get too far in this. Commandment number 2 jumped out at me. I'm the Lord your God, have no other gods before me. Okay, that's pretty clear, pretty simple. I don't think I can add anything to that. All right, so we'll let that stand. Second commandment. Second commandment is don't make any images or idols and worship them. Of course, the Jews immediately, Moses doesn't even come down from Mount Sinai. The next time without the Jews making a golden calf and bowing down to that. So they immediately hear the voice of God proclaiming this and they say, we'll do whatever you say. And here it is that they immediately, in very short order, matter of weeks, Moses up for 40 days, they comes back down again. They're already violating the second commandment. So I want to take a look at the statement of this, don't make any idols, as it's explained in Deuteronomy 4, which goes a little further. And I want to pick up with what we talked about earlier. Deuteronomy chapter 4. It's good to read Exodus and Deuteronomy together in this part of the Bible because they're covering the same material and sometimes you find a little more details in Deuteronomy. So Deuteronomy chapter 4, we're going to overlap with what we read previously. Moses said, the Lord spoke to you, this is verse 12, the Lord spoke to you from the midst of the fire. You heard the sound of the words, but saw no form. You only heard a voice. So he declared to you his covenant, the Ten Commandments, which he commanded you to perform. And he wrote them on two tablets of stone. Let's continue. Verse 14. Then the Lord commanded me at that time to teach you ordinances and judgments, so you might observe them in the land you're crossing to inherit. So be careful to guard your souls. For you saw no form when the Lord spoke to you at Horeb on the mountain from the midst of the fire. Do not act lawlessly and make for yourselves a carved form of any image, the likeness of male or female, the likeness of any cattle on the earth, the likeness of any winged bird that flies under heaven, the likeness of anything that creeps on the ground, or the likeness of any fish in the water beneath the earth. Also, do not act lawlessly when you lift your eyes to heaven and see the sun, the moon, and the stars, and all the adornment of heaven. And you thus go astray and worship and serve them, which the Lord your God assigned to all the nations under heaven. So the people saw no form at Mount Sinai when God came down. So he says, you saw no form, you don't need to create, don't create any image, neither male nor female, not in the form of any creature on land, sea, air. And also, don't worship things in the heavens. That would include the sun, the moon, the stars. Any of these created things, he says, don't make images of them and don't worship them. So I think of idolatry as creating another god. But idolatry also can be God saying, you saw nothing, so don't try to represent me in the form of something. So idolatry is both worshiping God in the form of the God of heaven, in the form of a created thing, which maybe what they were doing with the golden calf is they're worshiping God in the form of a golden calf, or worshiping another god. They're both prohibited by the command against idolatry. And I want to continue to pick it up again in verse 25. Deuteronomy 4:25. If you beget sons, and the sons of sons, and dwell a long time in the land, and act lawlessly, and make a carved form of anything, and do evil in the sight of the Lord your God to provoke him to anger, I call heaven and earth to witness to you today. You will be utterly destroyed from the land you are crossing over the Jordan to inherit. You will not live long in it, but you'll be utterly annihilated. Then the Lord will scatter you among all the nations, and you'll be left few in number among the nations where the Lord will bring you. There you will serve different gods, the works of men's hands, wood and stone, which neither see, hear, eat, nor smell. But from there you will seek the Lord your God, and you will find him when you seek him with all your heart, with all your soul, in your tribulation. And all these words will find you at the end of days, when you turn to the Lord your God and obey his voice. For the Lord your God is a merciful God. He will not forsake you, nor annihilate you, nor forget the covenant of your fathers, which he swore to them. Now, he's explaining. He says, look, when you go in the future, not only you, but your sons and your grandchildren, he says, if they get involved in this sin of idolatry, okay, I'm sending you into the promised land. If you get involved in this sin, or they get involved in this sin, I'm going to annihilate you. I'm going to wipe you out. I'm going to scatter you, and I'm going to take you into captivity in foreign nations, and there you will serve the gods that don't hear or speak, the gods of wood and stone. He says, this is what's going to happen to your descendants if you fall into this sin. And so God is laying it on the people here about what's going to happen to them if they get involved in idolatry. And this is like the first half of the Old Testament right here is just this playing itself out, where God makes it clear how upset he is about idolatry and what's going to happen to the people if they do. And he says, here's what's going to happen to you. But then he also says here, as much as he obviously hates this sin, he says, after this happens, I am a merciful God. And when you repent and turn back to me, I will forgive you, I will restore you, and I'll remember the covenant I made to your forefathers, that I made to Abraham and to Moses. So it just shows you God's faithfulness and his seriousness about sin, but his faithfulness to keep his promises and his mercy. But it's all tied up. So this is the big sin that Israel would fall into, the sin of the nations around the sin of idolatry. So this is the outline of most of the Old Testament right here. So as I mentioned previously, as clear as God is about this command, the second commandment, the people all hear him speaking from Mount Sinai when he speaks the Ten Commandments in Exodus chapter 20. They hear it the first time. And they immediately go off and make a god, the golden calf, and hey, these are the gods who brought you out of Egypt, and they in Exodus 32. So idolatry is a big problem for the Jews for hundreds of years after they go into the promised land. I think it appears that it got burned out of them in the Babylonian captivity. After that time, I can't think of any more examples of idolatry. So it seems like that one got finally ground out of the nation as a result of what they went through there. But idolatry, so it got beaten out of the Jews through the Babylonian captivity, but the pagan, all the other nations, the pagan nations were up to their ears in idolatry, really. They were just completely consumed with idolatry. So when the gospel is going out from Judea and Samaria and to the ends of the earth, the apostles, once they get out of the sphere of Judaism, are running into the sin of idolatry everywhere they go. So this was a big deal in the early church. Where the Christians were running into it. In Acts chapter 17, this is Paul's speech to the Areopagus in Athens. And I want to read from there, Acts chapter 17, verse 16. So he's evangelizing a pagan land, and this is basically another a sermon blasting idolatry. So Paul's a good Jew, and he detests idolatry, and he only follows he believes in one God, and he hates idolatry. So imagine Paul's experience when he comes into Athens, the big city, the great center of learning. Acts chapter 17, starting in verse 16. Now, while Paul waited for them in Athens, his spirit was provoked within him when he saw the city was given over to idols. Therefore, he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the Gentile worshipers in the marketplace daily and those who happened to be there. And certain Epicurean Stoic philosophers encountered him, and some said, "What does this babbler want to say?" Others said, "He seems to be a proclaimer of foreign gods because he preached to them Jesus and the resurrection." And they took him and brought him to the Areopagus, saying, "May we know about this new doctrine is that you speak, of which you speak? For you're bringing some strange things to our ears. Therefore, we want to know what these things mean." For all the Athenians and foreigners who were there spent their time in nothing else but either to tell or hear some new thing. Then Paul stood in the midst of the Areopagus and said, "Men of Athens, I perceive in all things you are very religious." He starts off with trying to find something good to say about them. "For as I passing through and considering the objects of your worship, I even found an altar with this inscription to the unknown God. Therefore, the one whom you worship without knowing, him I proclaim to you. God who made the world and everything in it, since he's Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands, nor is he worshipped with men's hands as though he needed anything, since he gives to all life, breath, and all things. He's made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on the face of the earth, and he's determined the pre-appointed times and boundaries of their dwellings, so they should seek the Lord and hope they might grope for him and find him, though he's not far from each of us. For in him we live and move and have our being. As also some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring. Therefore, since we are the offspring of God, we ought not to think the divine nature is like gold or silver or stone, something shaped by art and man's devising. Truly, these times of ignorance God overlooked, but now he commands all men everywhere to repent, because he's appointed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by the man whom he's ordained, and he's given assurances of this to all by raising him from the dead." So he just demolishes idolatry. He's upset about the idolatry that he sees, and he goes after it. And Paul did this everywhere he went. We see later on in Acts chapter 19, the Christians are having such an impact that they're cutting into the business of the silver idol makers for Artemis of the Ephesians in Ephesus, also known as Diana. So Acts 19 in verse 23. "About that time, there arose a great commotion about the way. For a certain man named Demetrius, a silversmith who made silver shrines of Diana, brought no small profit to the craftsmen. He called them together with workers of similar occupation and said, "Men, you know we have our prosperity by this trade. Moreover, you see and hear that not only at Ephesus, but throughout almost all Asia, this Paul has persuaded and turned away many people, saying that they are not gods which are made with hands. So not only is this trade of ours in danger of falling into disrepute, but also the temple of the great goddess Diana may be despised and her magnificence destroyed, whom all Asia and the world worship." Now when they heard this, they were full of wrath and cried out, saying, "Great is Diana the Ephesian." So the whole city was filled with confusion and rushed into the theater with one accord, having seized Gaius and Aristarchus, Macedonians, Paul's travel companions. And when Paul wanted to go into the people, the disciples would not allow him. And some of the officials in Asia who were his friends sent to him pleading he would not venture into the theater. Some therefore cried one thing and some another, for the assembly was confused. Most of them didn't know why they came together. And they drew Alexander out of the multitude, the Jews putting him forward. And Alexander motioned with his hand and wanted to make his defense to the people. When they found out he was a Jew, all with one voice cried out for about 2 hours, "Great is Diana of the Ephesians." So this is a chaotic situation. I mean, this, but now sometimes I hear people say, well, the Christians didn't have that much effect. They converted a few people here and there. Well, they're obviously threatening the livelihood. It's hitting people in the pocketbooks who are involved in idolatry. So they stir up the whole city. People are shouting for 2 hours in the theater. So it's because they're addressing idolatry. In 1 Corinthians in chapter 10, Paul talks about the sins the people fell in the wilderness as a warning of the Corinthians, the four sins not to fall into so you don't get disqualified. What's the first sin that he hits? Idolatry. Okay, he talks about the golden calf. He says, don't get involved in idolatry to the Corinthians. So that was obviously the background that they're coming out of. Paul in Romans chapter 1, is reading out of a commentary by Origen, because Romans has been so badly misused for the last 500 years since the time of Martin Luther, Protestant Reformation. So I'm trying to get a handle on how did the Christians read the book of Romans originally. And Origen talks about this, and he says, you know, imagine Paul is addressing people as two groups. He has the Jewish Christians on the one hand, and he has the Greek Christians, the Greek being representative of all the Gentiles on the other hand. So you've got two groups of Christians there. So you've got one group, and he's got the other group. He talks to one group, and he chides them, and he builds them up. Then he switches over, talks to the other group, knocks them down, builds them up. So he's talking to two groups of people. That's really what first 11 chapters of Romans, that's mostly what it's about. He's talking about two groups of people. And which is, you read Romans, and it's obviously that's exactly what he's doing here. He's talking to two groups of people and addressing one and then the other. And so here he starts off by going after the Greeks, going after the Gentiles. And in Romans chapter 1, verse 18, he explains how destructive idolatry is and how it's at the core of man's spiritual descent in all the pagan nations. Romans chapter 1, starting in verse 18. "The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth and unrighteousness, because what may be known of God is manifest in them. For God has shown it to them. Since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so they are without excuse. Because although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools and changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man and birds and four-footed animals and creeping things. Therefore, God also gave them up to uncleanness in the lust of their hearts to dishonor their bodies among themselves, who exchanged the truth of God for the lie and worshiped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. For this reason, God gave them up to vile passions. Even their women exchanged natural use for what is against nature. Likewise, also the men, leaving the natural use of the women, burned in their lust for one another, men with men committing what is shameful and receiving in themselves the penalty of the error which was due. And even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a debased mind to do those things which are not fitting, being filled with all unrighteousness, sexual immorality, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, evil-mindedness. They're whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, violent, proud, boastful, inventors of evil things, disobedient to their parents, undiscerning, untrustworthy, unloving, unforgiving, unmerciful, who, knowing the righteous judgment of God, that those who practice such things are deserving of death, not only do them, but also approve those who practice them. Now, it sounds like some of this is coming back, I think, as you're paying attention to what's going on in the world around us. But this is the spiritual descent of man that Paul describes. He says, God has made his nature, it's on display everywhere at all times. The nature of God is seen in his creation. He says there's no excuse for not believing in the one unseen God who created all things. But people started by refusing to glorify and thank God. And then it says that their hearts were darkened and they got degraded into making images of things and started worshiping created things instead of the Creator. And this led to every type of depravity that we see. This is the beginning of the great descent of man into all kinds of depravity, that idolatry plays a major role in it. And so you say, well, this is all interesting, Chuck. The Jews had a problem with idolatry a long time ago. And in the early church, it was obviously a problem. But what does this have to do with us? We've got other problems, not idolatry. Well, idolatry is still a problem for hundreds of millions of people in this world, perhaps billions, not in Asia and Africa, but not exclusively there, who are still worshiping and serving man-made idols. So this has not been eradicated from the planet by any stretch of the imagination, if you don't see very much of it around you in the obvious forms today. But idolatry is a bigger problem in our world, in the West, in Europe and America, than I think a lot of people realize. And I'll give 2 points to illustrate this. The first was, several years ago, I went to a conference in Rome. It was a Bible teachers conference. And so, you know, we were in Rome, the Vatican is there. So I'd never been to the Vatican, even though I was raised Catholic. I was kind of fascinated, curious. So a group of us went to tour the Vatican. And so, you know, we're long line there. And so we're going through. And so we go through the museum part first before we get into the Sistine Chapel, and then we go into St. Peter's after that, St. Peter's Basilica. So, and traveling and going through the museum part, and there are guides there who explain some of the background there, and a guy told me this who was working at the Vatican. I haven't found anything online to support this, but it sounded reasonable. The guide said, you know, Michelangelo, who did the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, which you're about to go in to see, he said, they have a lot of things of pagan antiquity in the Vatican Museum also. It's a lot of historical stuff that they've got there. They've been collecting it for a long time. a lot of treasures, a lot of artwork, and a lot of pagan art also. So he said, here is a head of, I believe it was the god Zeus or Jupiter. So this was the head of statue. And he says, this is basically what Michelangelo used as his model for God on the famous scene on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, the creation of Adam. And this is maybe the most famous Christian piece of art in the whole world. So I noticed that, and I saw, you know, here's an old man with a curly beard, and it's just the head. And so I go in there, and I look up on the ceiling, and sure enough, the face looks the same. It looks like this, the same face of Jupiter or Zeus on God. So I look up there on the ceiling, and this is the famous artwork. We've all seen pictures of it over and over again. You know, Adam is a barely clothed or unclothed man with a perfect torso, and he's got his fingers stretched out, and God has, you know, what's represented is God has his fingers stretched out. But God in the picture is an old man, very athletic looking, but he's an old man with, you know, eyes, head, face, fingers, hands, and he's reaching out to touch Adam, and he's got, since he's fairly old, being from forever, he's got white hair at this point in time. So he's got curly white hair and a beard, which indicates the fact that he's been around for a while. So I was looking up at the ceiling, and they explain, you know, Michelangelo had to do this on his back, on scaffolding, way up at the ceiling, and they're explaining, and you know, and he was doing it. He didn't paint it on the ceiling. It's a fresco. So he's putting plaster, colored plaster, and putting pigment in the plaster here. And they said, oh, by the way, he had this special ability to do things in a way that makes it look like it's 3D from a distance, but no one knows how to do that today. So on the one hand, I'm looking at this, you know, he did it, I think it was early 500. So it's, you know, this has been around for 500 years. So I'm looking at this, I'm just amazed at the beauty and the technical brilliance of this great artist on the one hand. On the other hand, I am horrified by looking and saying, this is the ultimate betrayal of the second commandment. It says, Deuteronomy 4, it says, don't make anything in the image of a man or a woman to represent me or any creature. And so here he is. He takes, bad enough, he takes any man, but then he uses, Michelangelo had a great appreciation for Roman and Greek sculpture. And so what does he do? He copies their techniques and he uses their models to put it up there. So I'm thinking, this is horrific. I was thinking, if I was the Pope, I'd commission people to go up and spray paint over that part of the whole ceiling. This is a violation of the Second Commandment. I don't care how good the artist is. You just don't do this. It ends badly. So I was thinking that. I was probably the only, you know, the thousands of people from all over the world trudging through there. Everybody else is thinking, oh, what a beautiful piece of artwork. And I'm horrified by the whole thing. And thinking, you know, how could they allow this to happen? You know, how much bad has been done by that picture over the last 500 years? How many people have you run into whose picture of God is the old white man with a beard who looks like he's Italian or European or, you know, Greek or something, sticking his finger out to touch somebody? It's just trivializing God. And God understood that. He said, when I came down to the mountain, you didn't see anything. You didn't see anything. There's a reason for that, okay? You didn't see anything, so don't make any images of anything. 1 Timothy 6, it says, it talks about God. We can't trivialize God. It says, God who alone has immortality, dwelling in unapproachable light, whom no man has seen or can see, to him, to whom be honor and everlasting power. Amen. This is who God is. And So, unfortunately, through the result of extremely talented artists who were copying pagan artists who were also extremely talented, it's a tremendous violation of the Second Commandment and has caused a lot of damage in the minds of people by trivializing God. It's also, this has also been, this is a problem for the Muslims. You know, the Christian art straying into idolatry with the pictures and the statues and things like that with certain branches of Christianity, you know, they know, the Muslims know, you're not supposed to, there's only one, they know there's only one God, they got that right. They know that you're not supposed to make any images of God, any representations of God. So you go into a Muslim mosque, there's nothing there. It's just geometric designs. There's no statues, there's no representations of God or anything like that. So this is a giant obstacle. This has been an obstacle historically for the Muslims that to accept the Christian faith. They say, well, how could they be doing this? They're involved in idolatry. And they've got a point. This has really defamed the cause of Christ by the blatant disregard of the second command here. But idolatry, so that's one reason why I think idolatry is still a serious problem in the West. And it's damaged the cause of the Christian faith. But Paul talks about idolatry in another sense in Colossians chapter 3. Let's turn there. This one hits a little closer to home. Colossians chapter 3, starting in verse 1. If then you are raised with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ is sitting at the right hand of God. Set your mind on things above, not on things on the earth. For you died and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is our life, appears, then you also will appear with him in glory. Therefore put to death your members which are on earth, fornication, uncleanness, passions, evil desire, covetousness, which is idolatry. Because of these things, the wrath of God is coming upon the sons of disobedience in which you yourselves once walked when you lived in them. So Paul refers to covetousness as idolatry. So why does Paul tie it to the second command instead of the tenth commandment? Okay, the last command is don't covet anything. And he says, your covetousness is idolatry. He ties it back to the second commandment. Why does he do that? So, in my opinion, because this goes back to what we worship and serve. Do we worship the Creator or do we worship created things? That's the essence of idolatry. What's the most important thing in your life? And that's, I mean, I think that's what Jesus said in Luke chapter 6. Let's turn there, Luke chapter 6 and verse 9. I think Jesus is touching on this. The coveting is a form of idolatry. In Luke chapter 16, verses 9 to 15. He says, I say to you, make friends for yourselves by unrighteous mammon, that when you fail, they may receive you into an everlasting home. He was faithful in what is least is faithful also in much. He was unjust in what is least is also unjust in much. Therefore, if you have not been faithful in unrighteous mammon, who will commit to your trust the true riches? If you've not been faithful in what is another man's, who will give you what is your own? No servant can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or else be loyal to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. ESV says, this is New King James, which is borrowed from the King James, mammon. ESV says more plainly, you cannot serve both God and money. It says, now the Pharisees who were lovers of money also heard all these things and they derided him. And he said, you are those who justify yourselves before men. God knows your hearts. What is highly esteemed among men is an abomination in the sight of God. So the way Jesus puts it, you know, I went to I listened to a lesson by Dave Ramsey on managing money. He's a financial peace guy. So he's got real good things to say about debt. I don't agree with everything that he says, but so a lot of things that he says are common sense and are biblically accurate. One of the things that he says you got to act like you're the general and your money is your soldier. So you tell your money what to do. You're in charge and you tell your money, okay, you're going to go to the savings account, you're going to go to the emergency fund, you're going to go pay the bills, you're going to go pay the mortgage. So you're the general and you give orders to your money instead of most people just kind of flounder around. So, but actually Jesus puts it a different way, okay? He says, no, you're not controlling your money. Your money's controlling you. You're serving money, okay? You can't serve two masters. You're going to serve God or you're going to serve money. Which one are you serving? So that's the idea, is that we are servants who choose whom we want to serve. So why is greed a form of idolatry? It's because you're deciding, I want to serve money. I want to serve the almighty dollar or whatever the local currency is. Okay? That's the problem. And Jesus says you can't do that. It's impossible. You serve God or you serve created things. Which one are you going to do? And then Jesus follows up the teaching as if it wasn't clear enough. Jesus follows up with the story of the rich man and Lazarus to drive it home. The rich man who served money and Lazarus, who did not serve money, okay? So, I want to take one more thing in this passage here. He says, in talking about idols, he says, you shall not bow down to them because I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. Now, does that word strike you as a little, when you're talking about describing God, maybe jealousy wouldn't be one of the top things that you would think of. But God describes him this here. He's saying God's merciful, he's loving, he's brilliant. But God is jealous. God says, I am a jealous God. That's how he describes himself. Now, isn't jealousy a sin? Okay? Sometimes, maybe, what do you think? I mean, God certainly isn't guilty of sin, but God says he's a jealous God. Well, if somebody said, I have a problem with jealousy, You think, well, you need to repent of that. But God, it says God is jealous. So what does it mean? So I'm curious, what does this word jealous mean here? And I was surprised to find out, I looked up in the Septuagint and said, okay, the word that is translated here, jealous, can mean either zealous or jealous. Mm-hmm. Okay? Wow. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, those are two totally different things. If I'm zealous or if I'm jealous, those are the two words sound similar, but they're totally different in English. But in Greek, it's the same word. So the same word is used, but you have to figure out from context which one is it talking about here. So here, in this case, the word jealous does seem appropriate. I'm a jealous God. I don't want to give my glory to anyone else. So jealousy is right. But just to give you an idea, when Jesus says, zeal for your house will consume me in John chapter 2, which is quoting from Psalm 69, this is the word that's used. When it talks about one of the apostles, Simon the Zealot, in Luke 6:15, this is the word that's used. So the word means both. That's the thing. Greek, English has a much bigger vocabulary than Greek does. So they have way fewer words. So their words words have multiple different meanings, where several different words in English, so the translators have to figure out which one. So the word can mean either one, and it depends on the context, but the word is the same. Now, I told Adam at the beginning of class to be ready. He's been sitting at my left hand here, as I had a question for him. So I'm going to use an illustration, the difference between envy and jealousy, okay? And to do that, I'm going to use an example from Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, okay? Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Now, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, there's an evil queen who is talking to a mirror. And the unusual thing is that the mirror talks back to her. So she's talking to the mirror, and she says, I'm going to give you the first half, and Adam, I hope you know the second half, because I'm going to embarrass you if you don't. Mirror, mirror, on the wall.
Who's the fairest one of all?
Bingo, you got it. Adam saved the day here. Mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the fairest of them all? And of course, the mirror says, oh, queen, you're the most beautiful one in the whole kingdom. Every day she asks the question, every day it says the same. And then one day, this mirror, now it must be a very honest magic mirror here. One day this mirror says, you know, you're the fairest, but there's somebody who's moving in pretty fast on you here, okay? There's somebody who's coming up pretty fast, and you better watch it. And then a couple days later, she says, mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the fairest of them all? And the mirror tells the truth. He says, well, sorry to tell you, but Snow White's the fairest in the land. You're just number two at this point in time. So what happened is when the evil queen was the fairest in the land and she found that someone was gaining on her, she was jealous because she owned the title of fairest in the land but was afraid of losing it. After Snow White was the fairest in the land, the queen was envious because Snow White had it and she wanted it. So that's the difference between envy and jealousy. Jealousy is you have something. Could be a possession, could be a relationship. You have something you're afraid to lose to someone else. You feel threatened. Envy is somebody else has it and you want what they have. You get the picture? Okay, so that's the difference between envy and jealousy. People often get them confused. So now, it makes sense to me that God is a jealous God. God owns the Israelites. They're his people, and he doesn't want to lose their affection to another God. So he is a jealous God. And understand this, we want to understand what's God like, okay? Just assume he's like us. God is the way he is. We want to understand from reading the scriptures who God is. So we learn here God is a jealous God. Now, God is not only a jealous God, but God will use jealousy. And he will even incite jealousy to accomplish his own purposes, which may seem strange to us, but that's the way it is. So let's turn to Deuteronomy chapter 32, because he talks about this, his jealous nature here. So let's celebrate the jealousy of God. All right. Deuteronomy 32. So I stumbled on this. I thought, well, this helps me to see some things in the New Testament, new light. Deuteronomy 32. Verse 19. So this is talking about the Jewish people getting involved in idolatry. Verse 19. So the Lord saw it and was jealous, and he was provoked to anger by his sons and daughters. Then he said, I will turn my face from them. I will make known what their end will be. For they are a perverse generation, sons in whom is no faith. They provoke me to jealousy by what is not God. They moved me to anger by their idols, but I will provoke them to jealousy by those that are not a nation. I will move them to anger by a foolish nation. For a fire is kindled in my anger and shall burn to the lowest Hades. It shall consume the land with its produce and set on fire the foundations of the mountains. So God says, I'm a jealous God. And he says, you provoke me to jealousy to the Jews. He says, I'm going to provoke you to jealousy. So what is he talking about? I'm going to provoke Israel to jealousy by those who are not a nation. I think about what Peter said in 1 Peter chapter 2 to the Christians. You are a chosen people, a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession. It says, once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. So he told the Jews, he warned them, you turn away from me, provoke me to jealousy. He says, I'm going to provoke you to jealousy by turning my affection on another people that are not a nation. He warned them up front that it was going to be payback in kind. And I think this is the point that Paul is making in Romans chapter 11. The Jews, he said, had been broken off as branches from a tree by their lack of faithfulness, and the Gentiles have been grafted in. Paul says in Romans chapter 11 and verse 11, "So I ask, did they stumble in order that they might fall? By no means. Rather, through their trespass, salvation has come to the Gentiles, so as to make Israel jealous." Now, if their trespass means riches for the world, and if their failure means riches for the Gentiles, how much more will the full inclusion mean? Now, I'm speaking to you Gentiles, inasmuch then as I'm an apostle to the Gentiles, I magnify my ministry in order somehow to make my fellow Jews jealous and thus save some of them. So jealousy is not always a bad thing. Paul says, I want to make the Jews jealous that they're losing their relationship with God. They're being supplanted by another nation that was favored, and hopefully to motivate them to want to get back in the graces of God. And to lead more people to salvation. And Paul, of course, warns us that just as they were broken off, we could be too. If the natural branches were broken off, then we can be too. So we shouldn't take our salvation for granted. So jealousy, God is a jealous God, and he uses jealousy. Let's keep that in mind. And we'll continue with the second part of the Ten Commandments next lesson.